think it was a couple weeks ago that we looked at the life of Jacob. And we looked at Jacob wrestling with God. And what I'd like to do this morning is to go back to the life of Jacob to an earlier account, which I've always found to be sort of a fascinating passage. Because it really tells you a lot about what Jacob's about and what is driving him at the core. It goes all the way back to really not his childhood, but the event in his life that sort of set him on the path that was ultimately God's destiny for him. But it was a path that was fraught with obstacles, to say the least, because of what's churning inside of Jacob. And it's found in Genesis chapter 27. Now, we're going to begin reading in verse 14, but let me just say this about the chapter to sort of let you know what's going on. Isaac is the father of Jacob and Esau, and there's probably other children there, but Isaac is the father of Jacob and Esau. Esau's the oldest by about 5 minutes. They're twins, and Isaac has loved Esau. Now, that was common in that day for a father to love the firstborn best, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But Isaac says to Esau, go out, kill something, get something, bring it, fix it, bring it to me, and bring the stew, and I am going to give you my blessing. Now, Isaac's blind, the Bible says in verse 1 or 2 of chapter 27. He's blind, he can't see, and Rebekah, the mother, hears that. She wants Jacob to get the blessing, and so Esau's out, he's hunting. She tells him, hey, hurry up. You got to get the blessing from your father. And so what's going to happen is I'm going to make some stew for you, and you take the stew, and he's blind. And so Jacob says, yeah, but he'll know I'm not Esau because Esau's a hairy guy. And she says, that's okay. We're going to kill a goat. We'll put the skin on you. We'll put one of Esau's cloaks on you so you'll smell like Esau. You'll smell real gamey and woodsy. You know, you'll smell like a lumberjack and all that. And you go in. Your dad's blind. He'll give you the blessing. And so that's sort of where the story takes off in verse 14. And he went and got them and brought to his mother. He went and got the goat. She wasn't going to catch the goats herself. He had to get the goats to bring to her to make the stew. Mothers, right? You got to catch the goats yourself. Okay. And he went and got them and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory food such as his father loved. And then Rebekah took the choice clothes of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. Then she gave the savory food and bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went to his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I. Who are you, my son? Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done just as you told me. Please arise, sit and eat of my game that your soul may bless me. And then Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God brought it to me. Isaac said to Jacob, please come near that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not. So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, and felt him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hand are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. Then he said, are you really my son Esau? He said, I am. He said, bring it near to me and I will eat of my son's game so that my soul may bless you. So he brought it near to him and he ate and brought him wine and he drank. And then his father Isaac said to him, come near now and kiss me, my son. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. And therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven of the fatness of the earth and the plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be anyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. Amen. Well, when you read this passage, it becomes, I think, clear to me that I don't know really what they're talking about, at least when you read it the first time, about this blessing thing. Because the passage is about blessing, and you read it and you think, this isn't like blessings that we give in our culture. I mean, in our culture, we might say something like, well, bless your heart. And that's sort of a southern way to insult somebody. Well, bless your heart, you know, that kind of thing. Or we might say, well, he was such a blessing. And we mean that, you know, he did a good job and we felt like we got something from it maybe, or it touched a part inside of us. Or we might refer to somebody else as a blessing in any number of ways. And what seems clear is that that's not what is going on in this passage, where Jacob is actively pursuing the blessing of Isaac. Now, on the surface, you might say, well, the blessing has to do with money and position. It's like a will. And so Isaac's going to say, this is everything that I have, and you'll be first in the family. And so that's what Jacob is after. He's after sort of what's in the will. And that may be true to some degree, but remember, he already sort of got Isaac's stuff when he sold him the bowl for his inheritance. I mean, I think if Jacob was just after the money, he could get it from Esau, because Esau's not so bright and Jacob's really sneaky. I don't think it's just about the money. It's just not about the position. You look at that and you say, well, yeah, but it's really almost like a prophetic utterance over you. It's almost like a prayer, because you look at verse 27, 28, and 29, and when Isaac does the blessing, he prays over him and he says, may the Lord do this and this and this for you. So it's almost like Isaac, who has maybe special standing with God, blessing Jacob and conferring on him a prophetic utterance of some sort. And you say, well, that's what it is. And that might be, to some degree, I think that's probably a part of it. But I think it's even more than that. Because what Jacob wants, I think, and what he is seeking in that dark tent, is an ultimate statement of value upon who he is. Because Isaac's the head of the clan. He's the most powerful person in the family. And what Jacob wants and what he has not got in his life up to that point from his father is for his father to speak into his life, you are valuable, you are loved, you are a blessing, you will be blessed. He hasn't heard that from his father yet. And so maybe there's a financial aspect, maybe there's a prophetic aspect, but I think the psychological aspect, what Jacob is craving in his heart, is to hear from his father, you are blessed from me. He wants to hear what the firstborn would hear. I mean, in this culture, the firstborn was exalted among the other family members. And to some degree, that makes sense, because they tended to have multiple wives and large families. For instance, King David, we're told at least 20 names of his sons. He had at least 20 sons, and probably more than that. He didn't spend equal time with all of those boys. What David would have done is what everybody in that culture would have done, is that they would have invested the lion's share of their attention in the eldest, in the firstborn, because the firstborn was heir to the throne. The firstborn was going to inherit the family business. The firstborn was going to be the head of whatever they were going to leave. And so they had to make sure the firstborn had been trained properly. They had to have had teaching in business, they had to be instructed, they had to have the time spent on them so that they didn't drop the ball for the next generation. So the firstborn got the lion's share of the father's attention. The favor fell on the firstborn. And to some degree, that again makes sense if you've got lots of kids. That's what Esau got from Isaac. That's not what Jacob got from his father. And that's what he craved. We don't have that, I think, probably as... Well, let me take that back. We don't have it in that way in our culture. Other cultures still sometimes function in that way. I know a guy who grew up in Peru, and he had a father who had seven wives, and his father was a multimillionaire in Peru, and Peru's a very poor country, and so he was very influential in his part of the country. He had seven wives and, I don't know, seven, eight, nine, ten sons, through these wives, and he wants, as I understand it, to give everything to his oldest son so that the family sort of keeps their position in that culture. And that oldest son lives in the family mansion. The other guys are out in apartments. They get a fairly meager allowance, but they know they're not firstborn. They know they're not getting the lion's share. They know they're being taken care of. They're not living in the mansion with the father. And that's what goes on in his family. I have a friend from Haiti named Salisa. My previous church helped her get through college, and we've gone down, and she spent a week with us when our mission team went down a few years ago. She came up and spent a Christmas with my family. And I remember talking to her early on in our relationship, and I said, so how many kids are in your family? And I think there are seven in her family. And I said, so in the seven, where are you in line? And I think she was fifth or sixth. She was on the tail end of her family. But she said, and I think it was the fifth, she said, I'm the fifth, but I'm the firstborn. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, well, I'm the one who went to college. I'm the one who was able to earn enough money to build my mother a new house. When my other siblings need something, they come to me because I can help them get it. I'm the fifth born, but I'm really the firstborn in my family. And that's part of her culture. And this is very much made me going back to this. She's the firstborn, although she's the fifth born. You say, well, that's that culture, though. We don't have that in our culture. You don't have people craving firstborn status in our families. We all know how to parent. We all know that that's important, not to be unequal. But listen, in the heart of everybody is really a desire to be the firstborn, to have somebody look at you and say, you are uniquely valuable, you are important, you are blessed, you are loved beyond compare. Everybody craves that. They do. Our kids, I was going through the house the other day, and so Jenny's got the girls in the kitchen, and she was cutting something. It might have been a pie or a cake. And Livy got mad because her piece wasn't as large as Ava's. We're talking very slender, but she got on top and deduced that she had been cheated out of a bit there. Why would she care? Neither one are going to eat it all anyway. Why would she care? Well, what everybody who studies kids says is this. It's not about the size of the pie. It's about the symbolism of the size of the pie. And if she got the smaller portion, it means that she's loved less than her sister. It's about the symbolism of the pie. And you say, well, that's kids. No, that's not kids. Why do athletes leave a team that they've played on their whole lives? They're loved by that town, and they will leave that team and go to another place to play for an extra $500,000 a year when they're already making $25 million a year. You know what they say? It's not about the money, it's about the respect. I wanted to be the highest paid. They didn't respect me. If they had respected me, they would have paid me $500,000 more than anybody else would have paid me. What is that? I want to be told I'm valuable. I want to be told I'm the best. I want to be told there's nobody like me. That's what I want to be told. And you say, well, that's just carnal. That's just carnal
sinners, not Christians. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. You know what pastors say? Not me, other pastors. Not this church, other churches. I want to clarify that. You know what pastors know? That they have to be as diligent to treat their church members equally as they are their children. They have to be, because if you don't, you hear from older ones, hey, you're spending too much time with the younger people. Why aren't you spending time with some of the older ones? We're here too. It's like, what? You're seasoned saints. You're supposed to be teaching. I'm trying to groom something over here. Why would you say something like that? Why would you say that? Because you want to be known that you're valuable, that you're important, that you matter. Just as much as a teenager. You might be older, but you still have a desire to be firstborn. I want to be firstborn. I want to be treated as well. I want you to know that I'm valuable, valuable. Like me, I'm valuable. And every, you know, youth pastor knows that the kids don't care an ounce. They don't even notice if you spend just two more minutes over here than with another. They don't even notice those kinds of things, do they? Of course they notice. See, it is a natural inclination to say, I want to be the firstborn. You have to tell me I'm valuable. You have to tell me I'm important. I have to be validated. It's validation. And by the way, you can't give that to yourself. You cannot look yourself in the mirror and say, you are a wonderful, great, generous, nice, important person. You can't give that to yourself. It has to come from outside of you. And our hearts desperately, desperately crave it. In fact, I read an article by a guy. He was a psychiatrist, whatever. But he said something that I think is true. He said, if you're a kid and your goal is to be happy in life, that's your goal. You want to be happy. You want to have inner contentment. He said, and you have two choices in life. The first is to take a job that you really like. Maybe you want to be a musician or something. Yeah, get a job, right? Yeah. You want to be a musician. But your parents think that's a terrible idea and say, don't do that. We've got friends. And when we're at places and they say, well, what is your kid doing? What did your kid? We don't want to tell them you're a musician or you're an accountant or whatever. Whatever job it is they don't like. Okay, so that's your first choice. Take a job that you really love, that is fulfilling, but your parents don't like. Or you can take a job that you really don't like, but your parents are so proud of you. Maybe they say, oh man, you're getting your MBA and you'll be able to come back and you'll be able to run the family. And you really don't want to get an MBA. You don't like finances. But they're saying, oh, this is fantastic. This is wonderful. You know what he says? He says, if you just want to be happy because validation is so important to you, you would actually probably be happier working the job you don't want to work, but having the validation of your parents, as opposed to having a job you really like, but feeling the scorn of your parents. He said it's that important that you receive validation as to who you are. But you know what? Our problem is Jacob's problem. Because in order to be validated, in order to be liked, in order to make people think that you're wonderful, we have to dress up too. I mean, that was the problem with Jacob. He got the blessing. His father looks, can't see, but his father says, I bless you. You're great. People will bow down to you. You're wonderful. But Jacob's problem is that it didn't do anything for his heart. It really didn't fulfill his deepest need, because it wasn't him his father was blessing. It was who he had dressed up to pretend to be. He knew it wasn't for him. Even when he heard the words, it didn't matter to him. Because later on, remember we talked about that 2 weeks ago, he's wrestling God 20 years later and he's saying, bless me, bless me, bless me. I need to be blessed. Bless me. It didn't matter here because it was for somebody else. And that's our problem, isn't it? We want validation and we want people. We need it. Don't act like you don't need it. Don't act like you don't need it unless you've never, ever in your life felt like you weren't treated fairly. Unless your feelings have never been hurt in your life, don't act like you don't need validation. Because the reason your feelings got hurt is because you need validation of who you are. So if there's anybody here whose feelings have never been hurt, you're exempted. But everybody else craves validation. But again, we dress up to get it. We act nice. I mean, we go on dates. Well, I hope you married people don't go on dates with other people. You're one person. But when you're single, you go on dates. And you know what you do to get them to like you? You admit that you like movies that you don't like. You're a girl. Of course you don't like Chuck Norris. You're a girl. Don't tell him you like Chuck Norris. I mean, you get in his car and you tell him you really like Kenny Chesney. Nobody likes Kenny Chesney. But you tell him you like Kenny Chesney. I mean, you're working so hard because you like him or you like her and you don't want to really act like you like them too much because they'll drive them away. Nobody likes to be like too much at the beginning because it feels clingy. And you sit there and you think for hours about when would be the right time to call them so you don't appear to be clingy. What are you doing? You're dressing up. Sometimes on Facebook, and this is just a guy thing, and girls can probably kick this back in any number of ways, but sometimes you'll see a girl on Facebook, and she'll say, I'm just looking for an honest guy. I wish there was an honest guy out there. And you know what I think, but I'm a nice guy. I don't put this on Facebook. I want to say, looking for an honest guy, says the girl in the 3-inch heels, the dyed hair, the makeup, and the eyeliner. Yeah, you're looking for an honest guy. You're looking for a guy that's letting it all hang out and being completely open about everything about them. Yeah, we are dressing up. I mean, and you know, on Facebook now, you got all the photoshopping. I was walking by my wife's computer a while back, and I'm walking by like this, you know, seeing what's going on. And I saw a picture, and it's like, what's wrong with her house? And the doorway in the kitchen is curved. And then my wife told me, see, you got this Photoshop where you can give yourself an hourglass figure, but you got to stand in front of a blank wall because everything behind you gets hourglass too. And it looked like her door was from like the Hobbit village, but the door got hourglass too. So we're dressing. You know, if you're married with kids, yeah, and I want to be generous with this. If you're married with kids, your house is clean like 20 minutes a week. And it may be closer to zero, but it's clean about 20 minutes a week. But when people come over, what do? Clean the thing, get in the closet, move. And I used to, you know, I'm a guy, and I thought, you know, that's silly. I hang out. Everybody knows everybody's house is dirty. Why do you clean it up? And I remember an older woman saying, see, you don't understand, she told me. She said, the reason women care about how clean their house is, a lot of women anyway, is nobody ever walked into a house and visited and walked out and said, wow, he's a bad housekeeper. They always say, wow, she's sort of a bad housekeeper. They never put it on the husband. It's always on the woman. And he's right, because I was thinking, you know, the last sort of semi-argument I had with my wife, sort of semi-argument, was about the cleanliness of her van. I finally had to yell in the house, clean your van! Because you know why? Because people are looking at that dust machine and they're saying, he can't even keep his automobiles clean. So I want people to think I got it together. And when she's, you know, I told her, I said, as dirty as your van is, when you pull up in a parking lot, people expect a Walmart shopping team to get out. Stringy hair, stained t-shirts, sweatpants, and flip-flops. That's who gets out of a van that's dirty. But it's about me. I want people to think that I got it together. There is that craving for validation. But we're like Isaac. We dress it up. We dress up, and that's not who we are. And so even when people say, we like you, man, that was great, you're wonderful. Man, there's nobody like you. Man, you're so gifted, you got it so together. We know that's not true. We know that's not true. We know they only like the clothes we're wearing. I read the autobiography, not the autobiography, but the biography of Andy Griffith last summer. And Andy Griffith was known as this wholesome, he's Andy Taylor, right? But time and time and time again in interviews, he would say, I'm more like Lonesome Rhodes in private than I am Andy Taylor. And Lonesome Rhodes was this character he had played before Andy Griffith's show, where he was a country guy, but he was a real shenanigan guy. It was all a fake. He knew how to play country. He knew how to put it on. But behind the scenes, he was mean. He was drunk. He was a womanizer. But he knew how to get on TV and just smile and smile. And to some degree, that was Andy Griffith in life. He had multiple affairs on his wife. He was probably a functioning alcoholic for 15 to 20 years. He was extremely stingy. In fact, the reason why Don Knotts left the show is he wouldn't give him 5% ownership. He had to have 100% ownership. He wouldn't give up 5 to his friend. I mean, there was a sense. And he was being honest. He said, I'm more like that character who pretended to be a nice country guy than I really am. And he was honest in saying that. That was really who he was. But everybody loved him because he was Andy Taylor, and they thought that was who he was. And to some degree, we're not that like that to the degree. But even, again, when people like us, it doesn't fulfill our hearts when we're dressed up like somebody else. Now, here's the great thing. What does that mean for you and I? I'm just getting at it, and there's one verse I want to get to here. Jacob finally, I think, changes when he gets to the wrestling match, because that's where he's saying, bless me. God, bless me. You bless me. Let me see your face. Bless me. And God finally blesses him. And that changes in many ways the trajectory of his life. And what you need today is blessing from God to change the trajectory of your life. There's a great passage, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22. Talking about the church, and he's calling the church many names here. He says, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. Period. Think about that. He says, you've come to the church, you have come to Jesus Christ. And coming to the church and Jesus Christ, you are now part of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. Amen. What's he saying? He's saying when you come to God, when you accept what Jesus Christ has done on Calvary for you, when you accept the inheritance that comes through Jesus Christ, you are a firstborn. There are no secondborns with God. Everybody is a firstborn. God isn't like Isaac. God wasn't like Abraham. He wasn't like Jacob, who all had their preferences. He said, but with God, everybody is a firstborn. And the great thing about it is, He loved you while you were yet a sinner. He knows your stuff. He knows your job. You don't have to hide. In fact, you can hide from Him. Adam and Eve found that out, but you're still a firstborn with Him. You know what? When you get that, a lot of things happen in your life. One of the things that happens in your life is you become a less hurtful person. Because this craving for validation actually makes us a hurtful person, although we don't intend to be. I read the biography. I'm using illustrations, by the way, that nobody under the age of 40 knows. But I read the biography of Cary Grant. Cary Grant was like the greatest actor of the last, you know, of the 20th century, at least according to the polls. You know, he's this great-looking, debonair, great actor, charming kind of guy. And he was married 5 different times. And he was physically abusive to at least one wife. He was very distant from the others. Finally, after his 4th divorce, he ended up getting into LSD use and psychoanalysis. But what he said he came out of that was this. This is what he said. Because he had a very terrible relationship with his mother. He was never loved by his mother, amazingly. Never loved by his mother. But he said, I punished every woman in my life because of what my mother did to me. He said, for 40 years, I punished every woman in my life because of the rejection I had from my mother. He didn't get the blessing from the mother, and he craved, but nobody could give it to him. And it made him a very demanding individual. He demanded from the women in his life more than they could give him because he needed validation that he never had from his mother, but he couldn't get it. It makes you a very, very hurtful person. Some of you might be working jobs and you're working long hours and you're depriving your family of your presence and they need your presence. But the reason you work long hours has to do with validation. You work long hours, you're climbing the ladder where you're at, you're making good money, and people are starting to validate you and say, you're great, you're wonderful, you're fantastic. And your heart craves that to the degree that you stay in the office instead of going home and being the responsible husband you need to be and the responsible father you need to be. Your family is suffering because of your need to be validated in your workplace. You crave it. You crave it in your heart. You'll be a less hurtful person if you can accept what Jesus Christ has done, because if you get it from Him, you won't demand it in ways that you do from others, and you'll get your priority straight. Listen, look at Jacob. Read him sometime. Read about him sometime from start to finish. Practically everybody who came into contact with Jacob up till the time he wrestles with God got hurt by Jacob. Got hurt by Jacob. His brother, of course, got cheated through the whole family. What Jacob did through the whole family in turmoil. He ends up trying to get Rachel to love him. And I don't know that Rachel maybe didn't want to marry him. Leah got hurt by him because he tried to get Rachel to validate him as a human being. He said to himself, if Rachel loves me, then that means I'm somebody. And that was too much pressure on her. And there's a massive fight you read there in Genesis between him and her. Things aren't well in that marriage. He throws Leah away. He ends up cheating Laban. Everybody who comes into contact with Jacob before the blessing gets hurt by Jacob. Now, he didn't go out to hurt people. That's just his personality. That's what happened because of this desire to be validated in his life. But you know what? You'll also be a less hurt person. You'll be less hurtful, but you'll be less hurt. Because here's the thing. When you accept what Christ has done for you, when you accept that blessing comes from Him, validation comes from Him, when you accept that, that ought to do something to your ego. See, listen, and I say this like 4 times a year because I want somebody to believe it finally. But you can't get your feelings hurt. It's your ego that gets hurt. You can't hurt feelings. Don't say my feelings got hurt. Say it was my pride that got hurt and then repent of the pride. Don't go around saying my feelings got hurt. Listen to me. If you're a Christian, just think about how large your ego is if you're saying your feelings got hurt. Because this is what you're saying. You're saying the God of the universe validated me. He loved me so much. He sent His Son to die for me. He wants to take me to heaven to be a joint heir with Jesus Christ. That's how much He thinks about me, but it's not enough because I need everybody else to validate me too. Now think about that. Remember the old Jack Benny skit? See, nobody knows these illustrations during the age of 40. But remember the old Jack Benny? Anybody know who Jack Benny was? Oh, yeah. Old comedian, by the way. Long before Eddie Murphy or anything. But Jack Benny would do this thing. He would play this rich, greedy guy. And here's the joke with Jack Benny. The guy says to Jack Benny, you got lots and lots and lots of money. When are you going to retire? To which Jack Benny does his famous pause. And he says, well, I don't have all the money. I don't have all the money. You see, he's saying, I'm a multi-millionaire, but the only thing that will satisfy me is if I get all the money. And you say, that's a greedy statement. How egotistical is it for you to say that the God of the universe loved me, gave his son for me, but that's not enough. Everybody else has to validate me too. What do you think about me? Don't hurt my feelings. My ego's out there. You got to tell me I'm wonderful. If you treat me like somebody else and a little lesser, I'm going to get my feelings hurt. I might even leave this church. I might do. How big is your ego when the love of God still isn't enough to fill it? How big is your ego? How big is your pride? Your ego is deeper than the ocean. Your pride is higher than the mountains. If the God who gives his blood to you still won't validate you, you got a problem. You got an ego problem. It's huge. And if you can accept finally, that God validates you. Doesn't matter what anybody else. Nobody's opinion is going to matter on the judgment day. God is going to look down on you and say, hey, the blood covers you, but I want to find out what other people think about you. That's not going to happen. His opinion counts. And when it begins to count to you, which it doesn't, that's why you need others' validation. When it begins to count to you, you know what? Your feelings don't get hurt anymore because your ego starts to go away. And if other people don't like you, and if other people don't think you're a great preacher, and if other people don't think that you're very smart, that's okay. It's okay. I mean, you know, I tell this story all the time because I want to be this guy. You know, the guy gets denounced publicly, called a heretic, goes out and smiles and says, I'm just glad they didn't know everything about me. Yeah, I want to be that guy. I want to be the guy who doesn't have the ego. God has filled it. God has given me. I rest on what he's done for me. I rest on Calvary in my life. And I don't need you to like me. It's nice that you do. And to be honest with you, because I still got some carnality inside of me, when you don't like me, it hurts a little bit. It hurts for a day or two. But you know what? What Christ has done for me overwhelms any negativity you can throw at me. See, you become a less hurtful person, but you become a less hurt person as well. You become a joyful person. I hope in your life you're not like Jacob. You know how old Jacob lived to be like 145. You know, they lived older in those days. But you know how old Jacob was when he was wrestling with God? He was 96. You say, now I know why his hip went out. Yeah, no, 96. Now, he lived to be 145, so at 96, he's probably in far better shape, you know. I mean, at our age, that's probably like 60. I don't know. But I hope you get the blessing to your heart before you're too old to enjoy it for your life. I do. I hope you get to the point where you understand Christianity isn't about taking on a new list of do's and don'ts, although that's there. It's not about praying a prayer, but when Christianity is about a radical change in your perspective, where you come to see truths that you never knew were there before, you come to experience the grace of God, the love of God gets all the way down to your heart instead of being just a theory to you. It gets all the way down into your heart, and it changes how you respond. It changes how you view people. It changes everything about you. If any man be in Christ, he's a new creation, the Bible says. I hope someday that you're able to get out of being a religious person, and I hope someday you become a new creation. I hope so. And many of you are there. Quite frankly, probably a lot of you are not there. You're very religious. You're not a new creation. Everything that bothers the non-Christians where you work, it bothers you too. you respond in much the same way that they do. They fall apart and you fall apart. They get mad and you get mad. They cry and you cry. You're religious. The difference is you come to church and they don't. But really, at the core, you're both the same. You're both the same. Christ came to do more for you than that. He came to do more for you than that. He came to forgive you. He came to show the Father's love to you. He came to give you a validation. He came to make you a firstborn with God. And if that gets to your heart, oh, wow, dynamite's going to explode inside of you. You're going to be somebody that you cannot imagine you could be. Will you stand with me?